So here we go again. It's another talk, another day. Story of my life. So this morning I wanted to talk. Sometimes I feel like that, just wire me up and I start talking. The automatic monk. This morning I want to talk about Satipatthana, insight, mindfulness, all that business. So I've been mentioning a few times during the last week about mindfulness and Satipatthana and insight and how it arises. And I think now's a nice time to bring some of these strands together so that we understand what we really mean when I say that you can't split up insight and samatha, and how there's only one path, it all goes in the same direction. And this is the subject of the talk today. It's also important because you know that what you're doing is not just calming the mind and getting blissed out for no other reason than just enjoying yourself, but there's something more profound going on at the same time. And that will obviously give you a lot of confidence that when you leave this retreat, you're not just taking memories of past happiness away with you, but you're also taking a lot of understanding or wisdom into the nature of the mind and the nature of the Dhamma, which the Buddha taught. But just to start with, just some basic parts of that Satipatthana. So I mentioned before that it's wrong to say that in the Satipatthana Sutta, the two suttas, Satipatthana Sutta, that's the only way to enlightenment. That's a poor translation of the terms. The only way to enlightenment is reserved in not one place, but many places in the suttas for the Eightfold Path. And every Buddhist should actually know that. There's a very fascinating and interesting conversation just towards the end of the Buddha's life, where one of the wanderers at that time, first of another religion, he was about to become the last disciple of the Buddha before the Buddha passed away into Parinirvana. His name was Subhadda, and he asked a very interesting question. And it's the sort of question that you should remember the answer to, because it's a question you'll be asked. And the question was that in other religions, are there stream winners, once returners, non-returners, arahats? Are there any arias? Do people get enlightened in other religions? And the Buddha gave a very wonderful answer. He said, in any religion, in any path, in any teaching, where you find the Eightfold Path, there you will find stream winners, once returners, non-returners, and arahats. If you don't find the Eightfold Path, there you won't find those people. Because he was pointing out a cause and effect relationship. You know, unless you have mango seeds, you'll never find mango trees. And it was just to say that it's not what you call the religion, whether it's Theravada, Mahayana, Hinayana, Christianity or whatever, it's what the person is doing. If you're creating the causes for these things to arise, then these things will arise. And it's again emphasizing that the Eightfold Path, the path, the way to enlightenment, is, as it were, like the only way. That's the path. So put aside that idea that Satipatthana is somehow the essence of the Buddha's teachings. The Eightfold Path is the essence as far as the way is concerned. But also that in that Satipatthana Sutta that I mentioned, and it's an extremely important point, that in the Satipatthana Sutta as the Buddha taught it, and this is the Satipatthana Sutta which at the end he said, if you practice this within 7 days you'll become enlightened. And I'm sure that many of you have been on Vipassana retreats for longer than 7 days and ask yourself, well, why wasn't I enlightened? And it's the same way, if you turn on your microwave, it's not working, then what should you do? Go and check the instructions. You must have been doing something wrong, because the Buddha doesn't say things as a lie. If the Buddha says something, that it's truth. And the thing is that you must mean that you haven't been following the instructions. If you did follow the instructions of Satipatthana for 7 days, then you would be enlightened. So what instruction aren't you following? And I've mentioned this to you before. It's the Vinaya Lokeya Bijada Manasang, which means having abandoned the five hindrances. So you've got to abandon the five hindrances first of all, because without abandoning those five hindrances, there's no way that the mind can practice Satipatthana. to the level which the Buddha expected you to. The five hindrances will take you away. The five hindrances will bend the truth, bend your perception, and you will never be able to actually to see the Dhamma. So that's actually the first job in Satipatthana, is actually to overcome the five hindrances, and that's always done through jhanas. In other suttas, such as the Nalakapana Sutta, the Buddha said very clearly that without experiencing the jhanas, the five hindrances, together with discontent and weariness, invade the mind and remain. But only with overcoming, so over with experiencing the bliss of those jhanas, do the five hindrances and weariness and discontent, only then do those not invade the mind and remain. And in many other cases as well, the Buddha said it's the five hindrances which are the food and nourishment of avijja, and it's only through knocking the five hindrances out that we can have an opportunity to see the Dhamma, and we have an opportunity to practice the Satipatthana. So that's why people on retreats who think they're doing Satipatthana don't get enlightened, because the five hindrances haven't been knocked out for 7 days. If you can knock the seven hindrances, I could say seven hindrances for 5 days, the five hindrances for 7 days, you can knock them out for 7 days, then you have a really good chance. In fact, you will certainly, as the Buddha said, become fully enlightened. But also, if you complete the instructions, and the rest of the Satipatthana Sutta is all about the four, I call them, focuses of mindfulness. And I call them focuses of mindfulness because if you start calling them foundations of mindfulness, it's one of these, again, translations which is sort of stuck in people's minds. What does actually foundation of mindfulness really mean for you? Like a foundation is what something stands on. It sort of supports it and empowers it. But really, what is a foundation for mindfulness? What really empowers mindfulness, as you will know from your own experiences, is things like samadhi, things like joy and happiness give it the energy. Like mindfulness, if you look at mindfulness like a flashlight, and where you shine the flashlight, you can actually see clearly, especially now at night time. So look upon mindfulness as like the flashlight. If you can have a good flashlight and you want to see something, you've got to have strong batteries. And if your batteries are very dull, then it doesn't matter how good the bulb is, you don't see very much. And you all know when your mindfulness is dull, when there's not much energy in your batteries. And you should also know that energy, I think you should have been able to notice this, at least this insight, energy and happiness go together. If you develop happiness, you've got lots of energy for things. But if you're really depressed and fed up, then you want to go spend an extra hour in bed. Or you want to dull out by watching the TV or taking drugs or alcohol. So it's depression and lack of energy go together. That's why we used to say in the monasteries that sort of life looks so wonderful after a good cup of coffee. Because just even monks were noticing, you know, we didn't have much caffeine in those monasteries in Thailand. And once you've got the burst of energy, you're happy. And what's it actually just showing here is just the connection between happiness and energy. And that happiness and energy is needed for the mindfulness, the strength of mind. So you can see clearly. That's the batteries. And of course, the best way of getting that energy is through samadhi. Whenever on this retreat or outside this retreat, you have a nice meditation, afterwards you're just so happy, and also you've got so much energy. People who have very good samadhi during a retreat or at a monastery, they don't feel like sleeping. Sometimes a long time, and it's not there suppressing anything, it's just the energies come through the body from the mind, and you don't need to sleep. Ajahn Chah used to do that. So sometimes he'd be up all day talking to people and doing things, and then at night time he'd give a talk. You get so much energy, you go on almost all night. Almost all night, because maybe 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, you say, okay, let's meditate. It's all right for him, because he could just go into jhanas and come out afterwards, and he'd be bright and breezy, and do the next day, but everyone else. But that's, you could see that his power source there, is samadhi. And that made him energetic, able to serve the world, but also able to have that amazing mindfulness. And you will see in your own experience that the foundation, if you're talking about the foundation of mindfulness, the energy part of it is from happiness, and the ability to keep your flashlight still so you can actually see what you're looking at, keep it still long enough to understand it, is again the stillness of the mind, the samadhi. So really, if we're talking about the word foundation of mindfulness, really that word should be about the fuel of mindfulness, which is like samadhi, and which is like energy. You know, those two indriyas, samadhi indriya and viri indriya. And that's really what I say is a foundation. But so the word foundation of mindfulness is an interesting concept, but the Satipatthana is much more useful and more accurate to the Pali to look at these as the four focuses of mindfulness. The foundations give mindfulness power and stability. Now you're saying the focus, what do you actually point that mindfulness on? Where do you point your flashlight? And obviously the next question is why you point it in these areas. And this is where the Buddha was brilliant in saying that point it in one of these four areas. Point it on the body, point it on Vedana, point it on the citta, point it on mind objects. Because that's where you'll find the treasure of enlightenment. So don't just go, when you get beautiful mindfulness, go out and sort of look at a flower outside. If you do so, the flower will just really open up to you and it'll be amazing and just blow you away with its beauty, with its wonder, with its depth of colours and textures. And sometimes you do that. I've done that before after nice meditations. Go out into the nature and just, wow, this is amazing. But it's fun to do, but the mindfulness is not focused on where you can get enlightened. You just get even more high and more impressed with the power of the mind when it's focused on nature. But the Buddha was saying that if you focus that powerful mind, you know, the powerful mindfulness on one of these four things, you're going to find something really amazing there. And what's the whole function and purpose of that empowered mindfulness is to see anatta, see non-self. And that's why the Buddha pointed in those four directions. Because each one of those directions is where we take ourselves to be. Either in the body, or as the body, or owning the body, or as Vedana. I don't like using the word feelings because Vedana is much more than feelings. Feelings sometimes confuses people as if it's like an emotional feeling. Sometimes it confuses people and think it's only the physical feelings in the body. But Vedana is that aspect of every conscious experience, so each one of the senses, which gives it the characteristic of pleasant or unpleasant. So when you hear a wonderful sound, oh, you're such a wonderful meditator, that's Sukha Vedana, that's Happy Vedana. When you hear a sound, say, you're nodding again, you say, wake up, come on, that's Dukkha Vedana. When someone says you're beautiful, when someone says you're ugly. And it's even like the smells. You know, when you smell lunch, that's Sukha Vedana. When you a smell wafts from the toilet, that's Dukkha Vedana. So whether you like it or you dislike it, that gives it the happiness, unhappiness. And I'll go into this in a few moments. The jitta, I've explained that, because this is what you see in samadhi, in jhanas or upachara, where you get nimittas coming up. And lastly, the dhamma objects. And there's one particular one which is important to watch. And of course, that is jhana, will, the doer. But in each one of these, the Buddha actually, first of all, just to get rid of a misconception for people, that sometimes when you don't know Pali and you translate literally word for word, you give expressions meaning which they don't really intend to have. And I think many of you have heard these Satipatthanas translated as you watch body in body, sort of feelings in feelings, mind in mind, and dhammas in dhammas. And that is just the peculiarity of Pali, it's just an idiom. What it literally means is you do body contemplation on the body. You do feeling contemplation on feeling. And sometimes you would ask, where else would you do feeling contemplation, then on feeling? Where else would you? And it's a good question. It's just the way that Pali is constituted. They love to repeat things. And there's nothing special meaning there. I remember as a young monk, we had all these theories of what it really meant when it said body contemplation in the body. And sometimes people write articles about that. Anyone who knows Pali knows that all that means is you do body contemplation. And that's just the way they write it. It's like, you know, you do eating on food. You do breath meditation on the breath. This is just the peculiarity of Pali. So it's just the idiom. There's nothing meant there at all. It's just body contemplation, Vedana contemplation, mind contemplation, that's all. Now when they say this, they say to do it atapi, energetically, mindful. Sampajana is important. Sampajana means like with wisdom. That's what sampajanya means. Pajanya is the same as panya, the word for wisdom. It means actually knowing what you're doing this for. So just don't do it blindly, not at all wondering what the goal is supposed to be. Everything you do should have a function, should have a purpose to it, otherwise it becomes meaningless. So we have to give our mindfulness a meaning, give it a focus. And what am I doing this for? And it's quite clear in the Satipatthana Sutta, if you read it carefully, especially if you read it in Pali rather than in the English translations, which sometimes just miss these points. The purpose of seeing this is to see that if it's body contemplation, that there's just body. Not my body. Yes. And each one of these, whether it's body, whether it's Vedana, whether it's Chitta, whether it's the mind objects, these are just mind objects. They're not me. They're not mine. They're not a self. That's the reason behind this. That's what we have to see. And the point is that each one of these is where we build a me, a mine, a self. Even our body, which includes the breath, which includes your arm and your nose and your hair and your blood. It's amazing just how many people, even though they've been Buddhists for a long time, even though they're monks and nuns for a long time, on the surface say, no, I'm not the body. When I die, you know, the body's going to be cremated and I'm going to be sort of floating out of my body, or mind-made body, or getting reborn or something. Many people have faith in rebirth, but there is still that attachment to the body, born of actually thinking that you are this body. That's why if anyone calls you ugly, you're the ugliest person I've ever seen. If you get upset, even a small amount, that's one sign that, you know, you're attached to the body. You take the body to be yours. Who cares whether you're ugly or not? When I was a young monk, when I was at school as a kid, I sort of fell over and one of my teeth got banged and went all black. And when I was a monk, I used to joke that it's my first line of defense against women. Had a nice black tooth. Until these disciples in Bangkok sort of twisted my arm so hard that they insisted on having it capped. But by then I was okay. But, you know, sometimes if someone's got a scar or gets a black tooth, why is it that people always have to go and get it fixed? This is a lot of advantages in being ugly. People leave you alone. You're more peaceful. Those of you, you know, who, if any women here who were very pretty and beautiful when you were young, you know what the problem was? It's like, you know, like all these bees buzzing around you, giving you no rest at all. So there's a lot to be said for being ugly, or being short, or being fat, or being sort of, you know, unattractive. So, but why? Why is it that we sort of get attracted, you know, get sort of caught up with this body? We actually really still think it's ours. The other time where you know what you're really attached to is whether you're willing to let it go. Are you ready to die? it's not you die, it's just the body dies, as you, you know, anyone should really know by now. But are you ready to die now? If somebody came in here and said, look, sort of, we need someone to die today, would you be ready to volunteer? Would you all be like, line up, take me, please? It's a very good time to die during a retreat. Because your mind is just so peaceful, its mind is on the Dhamma. If you're going to die at all, now is a really good time. You really get a good rebirth. But a week or two after you go home, you get all this old karma of getting angry at your husband. If you die with that sort of mind, what are you going to get reborn as? So this is actually a very good time to sort of die in the next couple of days. So why are we afraid of these things? Why are we afraid? Because the body, we really do think that's us. And we're not really willing to sort of let it go. Amazing that some people, we were fortunate enough, well, while we were in Asia, in Thailand, we could go to autopsies very easily. Because they expected monks to go to autopsies. But, you know, usually we make sure we go to autopsies on an empty stomach sometimes, because somebody... Some of the autopsies were sort of quite horrendous. But when we went to Perth, we managed to get to a few autopsies. The first coroner there was, you know, we explained what we were doing it for. We weren't just, you know, weirdos. We was actually for the understanding the nature of the body, and he was actually quite helpful. But then they changed, and there's been a few, I can't really understand, controversies about autopsies. Sometimes, you know, the coroner keeps parts of a person's body, you know, for research later on. That's that standard practice. It's every time I see an autopsy in Thailand, they just take, you know, a tiny bit of the liver, a tiny bit of the brain, put it in a little jar, just in case that, you know, there might be someone says that they were poisoned or, you know, some foul play later on, and they can, you know, take out some of those samples and test them. Or in case it's like a disease, and that's be interesting for research later on. But I read in Australia and in Perth and in England, when some of the relations found out they'd taken a bit of the brain, a bit of this and a bit of that, they got really upset. You know, you've got no right to take a bit of Uncle George. You know, we want the worms to eat them all. We want sort of the fire. That's all it's going to. I was really surprised as how attached people are to, you know, Uncle George's your relation's body, and how they got really ballistic about coroners taking bits and pieces of you. And also that this new coroner was saying that the relations would really be upset, you know, if a group of monks was looking over their body when they're having an autopsy. And straight away I thought, would they be really upset if we were looking over that during an operation? You know, when they're still alive, there's no problem at all. You can go and sort of view an operation, but an autopsy, when someone's dead, people get really cranky. And it's just, again, because of attachment to the body. If that is Uncle George, that body, and they want him sort of preserved, because this is the last time of his life, and they want him to be frozen in that state. So, the attachment to the body in our culture, which is rapidly growing to be American-European culture, is really stupidity. And it creates so much pain and trouble to us. So the Buddha wanted us actually to see this body and to realize it is just a vehicle. We make use of this body. So make use of it wisely. We don't want to preserve this body just at all costs, nor do we want to abuse this body. So we look at this body, our own bodies, our other people's bodies, they're just bodies, just as ours, so theirs. If you get attracted to somebody else's body, look at your body. You know what your body is like. You know what goes in one end comes out the other end. And you don't need to have attraction to other people's bodies. You know, when you're hugging and squeezing someone, remember what's just a couple of inches underneath what you're squeezing. And don't squeeze so hard, because it might come out. It's okay to be gross as a monk. All that does is realize it's just a body. And so people don't get crazy about bodies. You've got the most beautiful body and you get sort of attracted to it. Or if you have to have a beautiful body, then you've got to preserve it at all costs. And it does cost a lot to preserve the beauty of a body or the health of the body, the strength of the body. It's just the body, that's all. And when you see that in yourself, you see that in other people's, you just look at this body just as it's supposed to be looked on, as a vehicle, not as an object of worship, not as an object to be put on the front covers of glossy magazines, not as something to be pandered to, but something to be used for a purpose. And it means also that if we lose a part of our body or things start going wrong, we understand and accept this. It's not fear anymore. Because we understand this body is not me, is not mine, it belongs to nature. Nature will take it back when nature wants it to. There's not a self in here which owns this body. We've got to work with this body. Not against it, not own it, not be a tyrant of it, but work with it. Just seeing that much will give you a lot of peace. Those beings who understand the nature of the body as not me, not mine, not a self, who have practiced that first satipatthana and know that this body is just a body, that's all, should never be afraid of death, their own death or other people's death. Should never be crying at a funeral service of a loved one, nor should they be afraid of their own imminent death. And someone says, you know, that chances are you're not going to live for more than a month. They would take it, just the body is about to go. I expected that. No problem at all. A good Buddhist would have that attitude if they practiced that satipatthana. Fortunately, some of the disciples in Perth have at least achieved that much. One of the Thai ladies, who was, she'd been a nun for many years and then disrobed to look after her family. She's a very good practitioner. That when she went to hospital because she was having trouble breathing, she thought it was hay fever, but found out it was lung cancer. She didn't smoke at all, it was just other reasons. And she phoned me up as soon as the diagnosis was made, and I went to go and see her the next day. And after seeing her, she was fine. She knew she was going to die. She had it all arranged. The only thing she told me, but the other Thai people, tell them if they really want to see me, they can start come and see me in my coffin. Ha ha ha. And she started laughing all over the place. And as I was going out of the hospital ward, there's this big Irish sister. She was, what's the head of the ward? Not the nurse. It was a sister, that's right. Not the nurse, the sister. Matron, that's right. This matron sort of took me aside and said, I'm really glad you've come. She said, she's in denial. And I say, what? She said, look, she's in denial. She's not accepting her death. Because, of course, she's been talking about it all the time, the last half an hour, and she's been cracking jokes about it. So that's what I mean. Sort of, she can't have really come to face with her death if she's not angry, worried, terrified. It was fascinating. It was beyond this very experienced sister's experience on the wards to see someone who could be told they were going to die one moment and fully accept it a few minutes later. And make plans and be at peace with it, to the point of even making jokes. So good on to that lady. You know, she taught the sister what's possible. And this is actually one of the fruits of doing the satipatthana on the body. That you are not afraid of death, and you're not afraid of sickness. It's just body sickness, that's all. It's not me, not mine. The body is anatta. And that's what it means. The second of the satipatthanas is on the Vedana. Vedana, again, is happiness and pain, the beauty, the ugliness, so the pleasure, the unpleasantness, beautiful food, the disgusting food. When you eat today, when you eat your lunch, if you really want to do some satipatthana at lunchtime, get all your food and mix it all together. Get your spoon, if you have sweets as well. I don't know if there's any ice cream. If you can get some ice cream as well, put it right on top and get your spoon, mix it all up until it's a gooey mess, and then eat it. And then you actually be doing the Vedana satipatthana. It's just delicious or undelicious. What is that anyway? That's just the construct of nature. It's not yours. It's just taste, that's all. Pleasant or unpleasant, And if you are sort of really fed up with that, because you're not going to eat again until, you know, tomorrow morning, and this is it, and you've just messed it up by putting everything together and getting this really awful, awful concoction, then what are you worried about? See, the taste. Why is it that pleasant feeling always makes us attached, and we're sort of so concerned with pleasant feeling? It always gets mixed up in the stomach anyway, so as far as the how good it is to your body, it's all the same. So mix it up outside. Pleasant taste, unpleasant taste. How much does that control our lives? You know, when you sort of, someone cooks something for you and it's not quite as you like it to be, you get really upset. Or sometimes it's as you like it to be, and you think, great, let's have it again. Or the unpleasant sounds, you know, when someone calls you an idiot or sort of abuses you. Why do people get upset? It's just sound, that's all. Sound is sometimes nice, sound is sometimes unpleasant. The Buddha said there is nobody in this world who just gets praise and doesn't get any blame. Even the Buddha is the same. And there's no one who just gets blame. Everyone sometimes gets praise. Not even the worst people in this world. So praise and blame is just part of life. It's just freedom, that's all. Unpleasant and pleasant. Even kings and queens, you're supposed to praise them all the time, but even they get sort of blamed now and again. This reminds me of a funny story which came to my mind this morning. This is actually just a wise story. Because there's this man in Thai history who was a very smart cookie. And because he was so smart, everybody just was really jealous of him. And he really upset people. And all these ministers in one of the king's courts, they were ganging up on him to try and find out how they can pull him down and how they can upset him in front of the king. And so they hit upon this plan. They decided to, because he was very proud and a know-it-all, they were going to ask him in front of the king the next morning, sort of, you know, you are wise, you must know everything. And they were sure he was going to say, yeah. And so the next thing they would ask him, well, you must know what we're all thinking. And even if he could actually, through telepathy, know what they're thinking, they would lie anyway, and they'd say, no, that's not what I'm thinking. Because who can prove what you're thinking? And that way they'll show him up to be sort of a fool. So the next morning he came into the court, and at the right time one of the ministers, one of the courtiers, said, oh, here comes so-and-so. He's so wise, you know, he's so smart and clever. I'm sure he knows everything. And he said, yeah, of course I know everything. And they said, they took the opportunity, well, you must know what we're thinking. He said, yeah, of course I know what you're thinking. We've got him, they thought. What are we thinking? And straight away, without any hesitation, this courtier said, you're all thinking kind thoughts towards His Majesty. And they thought for a while and they said, yes, you're right. Otherwise it would have been in big trouble. That's called wisdom, the smartness. Because kings like praise. And just like you like praise as well. But you're going to get blamed from time to time. And this is just sound, that's all. And same with physical pain in the body. Now why is it that when we start to hurt in the body, and got sore knees, why is it that it's such a big deal? It's because we think it's my pain. Not only that it's my pain, but we think it's permanent. It's always going to be like this, so it's going to get worse. There's one thing about pain which is the best pain reliever of all, that pain is impermanent. I think you've all heard me tell the story of when I had typhus fever in the hospital, and I was only 1 year as a monk, and it was a third world hospital, and I felt very miserable, not just for the fever, but just, you know, where I'd ended up. It wasn't like a hospital in England. It was, you know, just more worried about sort of what you might catch in there than rather than what you actually came in with. And I felt so honoured when Ajahn Chah came to visit. the great teacher come to visit me. And you know, it really cheered you up for about 5 seconds until he opened his mouth. And then what he said was, Bama Wangso, he said, so, you're either going to get better or you're going to die. And then he left. That's really hard. I mean, you've got to hand it to Ajahn Chah. It was such powerful, deep Dharma. He had so many disciples, he didn't mess around, he couldn't waste time. And, teachings like that stay with you forever. It was true. I didn't need to worry about the pain. It would either disappear or I'd die. And that was the only two possibilities. So next time you go visit someone in hospital. If they're a Buddhist, you can do that and just see what happens. Now that's Satipatthana, isn't it? About pain. It won't last. It's anicca, it's not yours. And actually, that's a wonderful thing about pain. It will never last. Either it gets better or it gets worse, but it never stays the same. So when we understand that, we can let go of this problem about pain and pleasure in our body, or in our ears, or in our nose, in our tongue, or in our sight, or even in our mind. Because the pursuit of pleasure and the escape from pain is called craving. And that creates the business of our lives. And unless we really understand what this Vedana is, this pleasure and pain, and all its different manifestations, we'll always be under the tyranny of Vedana. Always rushing away from pain, never being able to understand it, being tortured by pain, and always being led by the nose, by pleasure. We'll never be free. So the contemplation of Vedana, in all its forms, not just physical pain and physical pleasure. We like to contemplate pain sometimes because it's a problem, but pleasure we don't think of as a problem. The pleasure is as much a problem as the pain. The praise is as much to be contemplated as empty as the criticism. So don't just go around contemplating pain. Contemplate pleasure as well. That's why people always contemplate pain. But how many people contemplate pleasure? That's why we do this type of meditation here. To contemplate the pleasurable things as empty, impermanent, not mind, not self. If you can do that, it's just Vedana, that's all. It's just pain. You hurt your knees, it's just pain. You go to a dentist, it's just pain, that's all. You have a very beautiful meal, it's just pleasure, that's all. It's nothing more than that. You have a nice sleep at night, beautiful cushions, it's pleasure, that's all. It's not me, not mine, it'll soon disappear. So you're never caught up with the pains and pleasures of life. You become free from them. You never tremble at pain, and you never become delighted and entranced with pleasure. Free. This is why the Buddha said to do that contemplation, because these Vedana entrap us in the web of craving. And unless you can free yourself from that trap, again, you'll never be enlightened, you'll never be at peace. Always be trembling. So that was the second Satipatthana, focusing on that because that's important to overcome craving. That's the key to overcome craving. And the third Satipatthana is on the mind. Two, having abandoned the five hindrances, to contemplate on the mind. The different types of consciousness, seeing them come and go, seeing them arising and passing away. And it's important to see the citta arising and passing away, because of all things that people think that which knows is permanent, and that's the real me. But the soul or the self is what's hearing all of this, and what's feeling this, and what's knowing all of this, the screen on which the world is played out, that's what people take to be the mind. Once you start to see, as I mentioned earlier, the television sets disappearing, the mind disappearing, the mind itself coming and going, then you realize that consciousness is just consciousness, that's all. and you don't get caught out with it. A friend of mine told me many years ago, maybe 25 years ago, he went just touring around Jamaica. And he went to a very rough part of Jamaica. You know, 25 years ago, so most of it was rough, but this was especially rough. And those were the days of drive-in cinemas. And when he went to this town in the remote part of Jamaica, the drive-in cinema which he saw there had a concrete screen rather than a cross screen. He'd never seen one of these before, and he wanted to find out why it was that the owner of this drive-in movie theatre had made a concrete screen rather than one of cloth. And when he asked a few people, he got the following story. In this town, it was a very rough town, most of the people had guns, and they used to really love westerns, cowboys and Indians. And sitting watching this movie, whenever there was a gunfight, they'd join in. They didn't like the sheriff, they'd all aim at the sheriff. They didn't like the cowboy, they'd aim at the cowboy. And the poor owner of this cinema had gone through so many cross screens, and he couldn't stop them shooting or bringing their guns into the theatre, so he decided to bite the bullets. That's a terrible pun, but there you got it. And to make a concrete screen so they could just go for their lives. That's a good symbol. It's true, it actually happened. It's a good symbol of how, why it is that people actually think they are the screen. And they get attached to the screen. And they sort of want to participate in the screen. It's the same, I remember, as a student going with a few mates and our girlfriends. This is, those people are old here, to see West Side Story. Remember West Side Story, the movie? You know the very end where Maria is running. No, Maria's by the lamppost, and what's the guy's name?
Tony.
Tony, that's right. Oh, you've got a good memory. You must be, but I shouldn't say very old. And Tony goes running towards him, and just before he reaches her, he gets shot, and he dies in her arms. Singing, there's a place for us, somewhere a place for us. And at that moment, you know, it's about three or four of us blokes and our girlfriends, and the girls started bursting into tears, and the boys started laughing their heads off. Really cruel. But you think, what are you laughing, what are you crying at? It's just sort of a movie, that's all. But the ladies had allowed themselves to get completely sucked in to the action. So when your husband leaves you, why are you upset? Why do you cry? You're just getting completely sucked into the screen, as if this is, you know, really important. This is you. Why is it when you get angry, you know, you get your guns out and try shooting, metaphorically speaking, just like those people in Jamaica? So it's because we haven't done enough chitanupassi. It just seems this is just a screen on which sort of cause and effect is run out. You know, in the old cinemas, it used to be quite good because people used to smoke in those cinemas. And it was good for this reason. Whenever I was getting lost in the action on the screen, you could always just see overhead this conical beam of light, wide at the screen, but you can actually follow it back. And you can see, oh yeah, there's a projector there. You can actually see the source of the images on the screen by following the cone of light back. Now, I think they don't allow smoking in cinemas these days, so I'm told, so you can't see that cone of light anymore. But that always reminded me that what was on the screen, even if it was an alien jumping out, or sort of, you know, a love scene, it was just acting, that's all. It was just images projected by a movie projector. When you notice that, you can understand what jitta is. The screen, the consciousness, it's not you, it's not a self. It just cause and effect, coming and going. And one of the nice things to know about jitta, about consciousness, you can't have consciousness without an object of consciousness. The two go together. So you can't have like an objectless consciousness, as if consciousness is something, something weird and something strange that can be without being aware of anything. This is what you can see in meditation. When the screen goes, or when the object on the screen disappears, the screen goes as well. It's like having a television. As soon as you turn off the channel, the television gets turned off as well. And there's no sort of empty screen there, just waiting, dormant but real, for something to play out on its surface. But if you contemplate chitta in this way, you understand that I am not that which knows. What is hearing this is just consciousness, that's all. And what that means is just it becomes a natural phenomena, similar to what the Buddha said, just like the earth. If the sun falls on the earth or the rain falls on the earth doesn't complain. If someone wheezes on the earth, or they put gold on the top of the earth, it's all the same to the earth. If you have happiness on the surface of the citta, or you have unhappiness on the surface of the citta, it's all the same to a person who knows the citta is just a screen, that's all. Whether it's a horror movie or a love story on the movie theatre, it's just a movie, that's all. So craving and attachment, building up all these problems and difficulties, all disappear when you really know what the citta is. Not me, not a self, not mine. And the last of the satipatthanas is the mind objects. These are the objects of the mind, the contents of the screen of consciousness. And there's many of those contents which the Buddha wanted you to look at. But I always say the most important one is chetana, is will, the doer. Because in each of these satipatthanas, the Buddha wanted you to see anatta, non-self. And the places where non-self, or the places rather where the illusion of self hangs out, what I used to call the citadels of the self. The two major citadels of the self is the knower and the doer. The knower is the citta, the doer is the will, the chetana. The knower is what receives information, the doer is what responds to the world with all the activities. The secondary places where the illusion of self hangs out is in the body and in the feelings. But these are the four citadels. These are the places, if you look there, that's where you'll find that which you take to be the self. And it's that which you take to be the self, you assume to be the self, which creates the problem of samsara. If you look at each of those four things and see it's completely empty of a self, then you realize there's no self anywhere. You've got to the heart of the matter, you will become a stream winner. So the Lord Buddha was saying, look at those four things. After you've empowered mindfulness through jhanas, after five hindrances are gone, look at those things and you see it is just body, that's all. It's just vedana. It's just citta. It's not a cosmic consciousness, it's not an eternal consciousness, it's just citta coming and going, an empty citta. It's just will, that's all. Not my will, not me doing this, but just something which comes and something which goes. On a secondary level, not my thoughts, the other important part of mind objects, it's just thoughts, that's all. Thoughts come, thoughts go, but they're not my thoughts. When you see it that way, then you see that each one of these is completely empty of a me, mine, and self. You let it go, give it away, you're a stream winner. You realize that that which you took to be yourself was something completely different. When people start to contemplate satipatthana in terms of non-self, that's its purpose, that's its function, that's what you're supposed to be doing it for. People overcome the biggest obstacle to the teaching of non-self, which is the feeling there is something in there. When you tell people, oh, there's no soul, there's no self, people who aren't meditators, who haven't gone deep into meditation, always object. Well, there's something, isn't there? At least, you know, I feel. Or there's something feeling, there's something knowing, there's something talking. So, you know, what is that? And this is the important thing about satipatthana. There is something. And that's something you give a meaning to which it doesn't deserve. In the same way, the simile of a mirage on a hot day. When you see a mirage on the road, where it looks like a puddle of water, you're not imagining that. there's real light reaching your eye. It's an image. But the point is that you're adding something to that which it doesn't deserve. Perception is not being accurate. Perception is adding another supposed reality on what's there. It's a puddle of water. If it's pointed out to you, it's just a reflection of the sky, that's all. It's a mirage. In the same way, there is something there, but perception changes this to be me, to be mine, to be a self. What actually is there is just what we call the empty process. It's just body, running according to nature, running according to biology, biochemistry. There is Vedana, just running according to the rules of Vedana. Every bit of pleasure is a gap between two moments of pain. Every pain is a gap between two moments of pleasure. Check that one out and you'll see. Those people have lots and lots of pleasure, they still experience pain. Slightly less pleasure than normal is pain. If you eat really, really good food, then when the food is not quite as good as it usually is, that's disgusting. When you eat frogs every day, one day when the frog is especially tender, oh, that's delicious. It's amazing in Thailand, eating disgusting food, after a while you got to like it. You only got to like it when it was a bit less disgusting than the day before, and that became delicious. That's what delicious means, just a bit less disgusting than the day before. That's what disgusting means, just less delicious than the day before. That's what it is. And to see that this is that which we take to be a me and mine is just this process of Vedana. It's just this process of consciousness. That which knows is not a being. We see what it truly is. We don't give it this extra description of a person, of a self, a soul. These objects which arise in the mind, like the doer, we see the doer for what it truly is. It's hard to do that, because we don't want to give up our identity. You know that as a young man in the Christian tradition, the most frightening thing was if the devil came along, the Christian devil, and came to take over your soul. You can give everything else, but not your soul. These days, if the devil came along, a Christian devil came along, and offered me $1 million for the nuns' monastery to take my soul over, I'd accept the deal. I get $1 million, devil get nothing. So I don't mind selling my soul to the devil. He's got the wrong end of the deal. Anyway, the major point of that sort of little anecdote was that when you actually look at the at this thing we call the doer, it's so hard to let go of, because that is fundamentally us, and that's what we're most afraid of not to be. And it's a strange thing, of all the cravings. You've got the craving for sensory pleasure, is reasonably easy to see, but the craving to be, the bhava dhanha. You actually, I've seen this when people are dying. They'd rather be in pain and live than to die and get rid of the pain, because they think they're going as well. They'd rather exist than have suffering than not exist at all. It's a strange phenomenon. It's called the craving to be. It's much more powerful than the craving to be happy. They'd rather be both, be and be happy. But given a choice between the two, they'd rather just be, even in misery. That craving to exist, that craving to be, is what stops you seeing non-self and stops you stopping. So where we actually see this, that the jitta and the doer, that which knows and that which does, is completely empty. There's something there, just a process. There is chaitanya. Chaitanya, will, choice, is. You can see it happening, but it's not me doing it. Sometimes it's frightening when you first see that. One of the things which really blew me apart when I started investigating chaitanya and will, that Satipatthana, was I'd given a talk at our centre in Nolamara. And I usually have our talks on a Friday evening, The following Saturday morning, I was just looking in the library, just basically killing time and waiting for something to happen. Forget exactly what I was supposed to be doing, but I had a spare hour or two. And I just happened to notice that in the recorded talks, I'd given a talk on exactly the same subject, the same title, about 6 or 7 years before. And so just for interest, I thought, I'll get this tape out and I'll just play it and see, you know, see how I presented the same subject 7 years ago. And when I started playing it, that's when sort of shivers went down my spine. Because I remembered precisely what I'd said the night before. And when I was playing this tape, and it was 7 years ago, I was repeating myself in whole paragraphs. Same words were coming out, and there was 7 years gap. And what really shook me was I really thought that the night before I'd had free choice, that I could choose whatever word I wanted to say in whatever combination with other words. And the coincidence was just too strong. Where I thought I was exercising free choice, I couldn't have been. And it started to show me the illusion of free choice. And I started remembering sort of experiences from my youth. I already mentioned I was a member of the Psychic Research Society. Every year we used to get a hypnotist to come and give a demonstration. It was good fun. Because you always be able to hypnotize someone to do something stupid. No, students like to do things like that. And it's also, the hypnotist would also, you know, talk a lot about the mind. And hypnosis is a part of the weirdness, the strangeness of the mind. And one thing actually told us and demonstrated, you can hypnotize someone to do something completely out of character. For example, I could hypnotize one of your Sri Lankans here that during, at the end of my talk, when I just scratch my right ear, that's a signal, to stand up and in front of everyone to sing the Sri Lankan national anthem. Okay, and I hypnotized them in the interview period. And I wouldn't do this, is that an example? And I gave them the post-hypnotic suggestion that you'll forget you've been told this, but in the next talk when I scratch my ear, come on, you'll get up and sing the Sri Lankan national anthem. And so you do that and they sing it. Now the important thing is here that after they sang the Sri Lankan national anthem, I know, and everyone else has seen them being hypnotized, know they had no choice. It was something completely out of character, completely stupid, and the only reason they did that was because the hypnotist told them to. But you ask them why they did that, and they'll always justify it. They will say they decided to do it. Not only that, they'll be utterly convinced that they freely chose to sing. It will appear to them no different than when they freely choose that to go out to the toilet now, because you know, you want to go and go to the loo. That free will is, but we take it to be something it's not. We really think it's coming from us. And experiences like that prove without a shadow of doubt appearances are deceiving. We think we're doing this, but you're not. In that particular case with the hypnotist, it's absolutely clear. It appears that you're choosing, but everyone else could actually prove to you without a shadow of doubt you had no choice whatsoever. That was caused by the hypnotist. It's fascinating when you see things this way. It really sort of starts to upset you a bit. So if you have no free will, you know, why keep the five precepts? You've got no choice. You have to. I told you. Yeah. Well, why do you say to yourself that? Where did that choice come from? No, it didn't come from that. It came from somewhere else. So we are always hypnotized. You just watch a television, and the hypnotist is telling you to buy Colgate toothpaste. Buy Colgate toothpaste. And why is it when you go to the shop, you actually buy Colgate toothpaste? And actually, to you, you've got a choice. I can buy Colgate, I can buy Palmolive, or whatever else is toothpaste there. Why do you always buy that one? Any advertiser knows that advertising works. But everyone who goes to the shops thinks it works on someone else, not me. Yeah? Absolutely, you're going to Nirvana, you've got no choice about it. So you might as well shut up sort of thinking and worrying about these things and just enjoy the journey. Why do people change their karma? It's why most people change their karma is because the Buddha became enlightened. It's not up to you, it's the Buddha changed your karma. Now, because the Buddha changed my karma, I'm changing your karma enormously. And sometimes you go outside and you become a better person. It's nothing to do with you, it's because of me. It's nothing to do with really me, it's because of Ajahn Chah, my teacher, because of his teachers.
So you're talking about the concept of
interdependence? Interdependence, absolutely. And you know where the buck stops? At the Buddha. His enlightenment has affected people enormously. Oh, yeah. The reasoning, yeah, and you see the causes and effects, which is all about what science is. This is the effect, what caused it. That's right, yes.
It's a bit unnerving.
Absolutely.
But obviously, we have freedom to respond to certain.
Do you? What has? What has been responded? Yeah, but it's all sort of conditioning.
Drawing from what's around, what's available.
What's drawing around? Is there actually a person in there, sort of at the controls? Yeah, but we suggest that's just another cause. It's just you feed it in, like a computer, and you get something out the end. Is there somebody actually inside the computer deciding I can take this but not take that? Or even what's inside the computer, the filter, is that not just put in there by another cause? There's a process there.
There's choice,
yes. It's not a person choosing. It's a process choosing. It's all cause and effect. If you look at that cause and effect, why do I do what I do? And I can actually trace, you can only trace so far back because it goes back. So many people, so many experiences choose you to do this. And I see, you know, the people who influence me most in my life. Now why I tell jokes is because my father told jokes. You know, he had a similar personality telling stupid jokes just like I do. It's not my fault. Indeed, it's not their fault at all. Why am I a monk? It's not my fault at all either. You know, why do I meditate? Why do I teach like this? It's, you know, the teachers I have. And sometimes you hear yourself just repeating your teachers. And this is fascinating actually to look at that jhana and choice and just realize what it is. There was actually a recent experiment was done over in, because I always collect these things in science journals. They had the, and it's again proving the illusion of will. I've got still got a copy of the article in Perth. This is something which is called the readiness potential, which is measurable in the brain, which always precedes an action. And in this particular psychology experiment, people doing the exercises, the subjects, whatever, they were just asked every now and again just to flex their wrist. Okay? And you can actually measure brain potential in the brain when, just before the wrist would be flexed. So you can see when the The process of flexing the wrist started in the brain when it was a decision, a brain decision, to flex the wrist. They also had a little buzzer or a little button in the other hand where they could press when they decided to flex the wrist. And they managed to measure for reaction time. But what the interesting thing they found out was when they were aware of deciding was after the redness potential had already begun. That will did not start the process. The process already began, and then will, choice, manifested. I knew it. You had no choice but put your hand up, you know. Sorry? The intention actually doesn't start the process. The process is already underway, and that which we take to be intention manifests. I want to do this. That's why you can't stop.
So can you do it?
Yeah.
Prior to intention.
What, the redness potential?
Yeah.
If you're very mindful and sharp, and your NC will come up. Yeah?
Does that mean that closely, the more you become nothing, the more you come to that moment where the choice is actually made? It's like where the Buddha had the choice between nirvana and going on.
Well, actually, the Buddha, once he saw that, there was no choice. This is actually powerful. You know the idea of like a bodhisattva putting off their enlightenment? If you actually see this clear for you, just how impossible that is. You've got no choice in this. The process, yeah. The idea that I'm going to stop my enlightenment for all other beings is a wonderful idea, but it just cannot be done. It's just like you're getting on the non-stop train from here to Melbourne, and then you think you're going to get off halfway for the benefit of all sentient beings. Just the train will not stop for you. There is choice. Choice is, you can see it, it's real, but it's not coming from you. It's not my choice.
It takes the pressure off.
It takes immense pressure off, yeah. But it's also, you find choice, you make choices, you make decisions, but if you look carefully, that's just the way we talk about it. It's not you making the decision. You just watch the decision being made. So the doer becomes a process, not a person. It becomes the doing rather than the doer. And that makes it very easy, as you said, to let go of the doing. When you know it's not a manifestation of you. Yeah?
Yeah, I think the will is just like energy. It is like energy is like from the real world. I can feel the energy that it's around. It's like it's going something.
Yes, it's good. Energy is a good description of it. But when you're walking, and many people have this experience when they're walking meditation, it's a good thing to reflect upon, they're not doing walking. They're just watching and the body's walking. You wonder, why does this foot go in front that way and then the next foot go that way and you're not ordering it at all? You're just standing back and it's happening all by itself. If you can actually do that with the mind, when a thought comes or a decision comes, it's just a decision happening, completely automatic. Nothing to do with you. Now these are really great. Don't think too much about it. Just allow it to really go inside, because I'm changing your perceptions. Because, you know, absolutely. You never looked at things like this before. And this actually gives a different perspective. Seeing the mirage, instead of sort of seeing the water down, they say, look at the sky, you see, it's the sky, it's making the water make sky and the heat. And after a while, when you point it out long enough, then you can actually see, Jade, no, it's not me, not mine, not a self. One of the citadels of the illusion of self is gone. So if the will isn't you, the no isn't you, who is you? No one there at all, completely anatta. complete non-self, complete empty of a self, and all that which you took to be a self, the doer, the knower, you see precisely what it is, just the empty process. There is something there, but that is just a process.
So why there is no such thing as a bad meditation? Like you can't feel guilty or like you're failing in a particular moment because you're not controlling your walking or something.
That's right, it's all part of the process, it's part of the course. So you can have some bad meditation, you can have some wonderful meditations. And you keep on thinking, why can't I just have the good meditations? Why do I have to keep on having the bad meditation, you stupid girl? And that stops. So you just let go. And because you let go, actually, most meditations are good then. Because you look upon them as good. The beautiful nimitta, super nimitta. Yeah?
Then why do they say, right effort and put effort into what you're doing?
Because if the Buddha never said that, people wouldn't put right effort in. So this is actually creating right effort in all of his disciples. So you've got no choice now, you have to put right effort.
If that's nothing to do with us, it's some other force.
Absolutely, yes.
But so why bother?
Because you've got no choice, you have to bother. No, it's good to blame the children because then you're actually convincing them, you're brainwashing them to do the right thing. This is what the idea of blaming is, isn't it? To try and make them do better. We try and condition them, but blaming as a condition is not very satisfactory. Praising is by far better. So if you want to brainwash your children and create will to do good in your children, praise them when they do good. And that's by far a better conditioner. But people, your question was, anything, because most people think this, well, if there's no free will, why do you do anything? And the thing is, that if you think, why do we do something, you think you have got the choice, there is free will. But because there ain't, because there is will, but it's not coming from you, it's completely conditioned, it's not coming from God, because this is the Christian idea of free will. You've either got free will, or it's all ordained by God. In other words, you're in charge, or God's in charge. Buddhism is different than both extremes. Buddhism is conditions are in charge. Conditionality, process, emptiness. So it's not God's will. That's why I tell this story when I was about 21, 22. I went to India to try and find the holy places. I didn't get very far because even those days no one knew where they were. I remember going to the tourist office in Delhi and asking where Lumbini was. And no, Kusinara. They didn't know. They got the maps out. They couldn't find it. So I gave up. But anyway, I was going in the mountains and around Kashmir, and all the drivers around there were Muslims. And this was, early 70s. And just all the roads were dirt roads, single track, on these mountains. And there'd always be like a huge cliff on one side going up and another cliff on the other side going down. It was really dangerous. And you'd look out there, you'd see buses which had fallen over. But you keep on telling the bus driver to slow down and take it easy. And the bus driver would turn around and say, if it's Allah's will we fall over, it's Allah's will. I say, yeah, but I'm a Buddhist. Some of you, may have had those experiences. And I reflected afterwards, if the bus does fall over, the Muslims, they would say it's Allah's fault. The Christians say it's an act of God. If it's a Buddhist, a real Buddhist, you'd say it's because it's a stupid driver. It's just cause and effect, that's all. Because of the driver's stupidity, that's why the bus goes over. It's not some, will outside of you. It's not some God, it's not some will inside of you. It's cause and effect, otherwise known as karma.
If that stupid bus driver actually was predetermined.
No, I tried to redetermine it by calling him stupid and please slow down. Yeah, it's part of Sankara. It's the biggest part of the Sankara aggregate. And actually, that's why the Buddha actually said that Chaitanya, Chaitanaham Vadami Kamam, Chaitanya is karma. And of that Sankara, he I forget exactly which sutra it was, but he actually pointed out that Chaitanya is the biggest one of those, of the Sankaras. Chaitanya is the word for will, the mind moving.
What relationship does Jaina have to that process of the cycle of view, perception, thought.
View, perception, thought, you know, form, view, and perception. It's almost perception has already, Chaitanya has already happened. The mind has moved actually to choose the perceptions. That's why people who think that bare perception is true, they miss so much. That bare perception has already been bent. It's even before you thought, you just look outside there. The sky is blue. Is it? You already perceive something. You've actually filtered out a lot more. So even bare perception can be deceiving. Especially when, you know, you look at your loved one. You really are beautiful. You're actually adding so much onto the world, which isn't there. Now, what's your favourite food? All your Sri Lankans who like dal. Is dal really delicious? Of course it is. Look, I taste it. This is bare perception. But, you know, you add so much onto life, don't you? So whenever we even perceive, like, you know, the wind is cool. Is it cool or is it hot? If you're an Eskimo, all wind is hot. If you sort of come from the desert, this is cool wind. So perception's already, Chaitanya's already moved. The mind has moved and you've chosen certain perceptions, certain ways of looking at it over others. That's why you have to use Chaitanya to develop the beautiful perception. Or rather, I have to use my Chaitanya to try and brainwash you to get the beautiful perceptions. And then from the perception we get the thoughts, and then the mind has really moved then. And that's when certainly we're aware of thoughts as will. I want to go to the toilet. The Chaitanya has already moved, and this is very often how we review an intention which has already happened with thought, giving it a name, describing it, commenting on it.
So actually, samkhara happened before perception and feeling and consciousness?
Not really, no. It's just there's a Chaitanya of mind is moving, and almost immediately these things come up. Going in a group, yeah. But Chaitanya is the leader of the group. It leads, pushes this direction or that direction. But it's not a person as a leader, it's just every process.
So the bus driver,
it's automatic. There's no bus driver. You know, that's the empty bus. That particular bus driver didn't, otherwise I wouldn't be here to tell the story. Thank goodness. Yeah? What happened to him? I came mostly sort of stupidity. Could have been drinking, could have been all sorts of things. It was his choice to drive fast. It was his, you know, the choice. He thought he was driving fast. He thought he was doing the right thing. But it's so many causes make you do those things. So, you know, why does any person do what they do? Why does it sometimes turn out to be correct, sometimes turn out to be a tragedy? And you can see all those causes. If you're very, a lot of mindfulness, a lot of clarity, why did I choose to do this? And you can actually look back and see that all these particular causes and conditions forcing you in this one particular direction. So you try your very best and see what happens.
And then I think at the moment of people, whatever they do,
yeah,
whether we look, we see, perceive it as good or bad, but at that moment the person who performs thinks they are doing the right thing. That's why they do it.
Yeah, they haven't really got, in the context of today's talk, they haven't really got a choice. As long as they've been around good people, right, they do the right thing. As long as they've got mindfulness, they've got more chance of doing the right thing. Because good and bad is just, this is what the Buddha's advice to Rahula. Good karma is whatever creates happiness for yourself and happiness for others. Bad karma is what creates hurt for yourself and hurt for others. And it's absolute stupidity to do what's going to hurt yourself and hurt others.
Just get... We don't blame them for fighting.
Absolutely. No blame. Because I can understand prisoners why they did that, and sometimes you look, if I was in that situation, you know, born with that sort of like, those parents, that upbringing, that, what would I have done? That's why it's so difficult to blame people. Even like monks, you know, who do stupid things. You know, you can see, well, why did they do that? If I was like that, if I was in that situation, had all that input, what would I have done? And I look at myself and you think, you're just being arrogant if you think you could have done better. It's so easy to blame, but you put yourself in another person's, you know, shoes, or put yourself in another person's sandals if they're a monk, and then, and then, well, what would I have done? When you understand conditioning, you sort of, it's very hard to blame, or even to praise. So that's enough for today. Any more questions, leave for this evening, and don't think too much about Satipatthana. Yeah, it's all conditions. I'll try to condition you not to. So it's fascinating, the Dhamma. The best talks are not just repeating what you already know, so you feel very satisfied, oh yes, that just gets you into dullness. I try to challenge people on these retreats, and so I hope I've challenged you today with my Satipatthana talk, and especially on will.